Does anyone have a question or anything to say? So I'd like to call this talk barefoot. That means nothing on your feet. Barefoot. I want to start by telling a funny way that my mind went with a good Zen story that I heard first a long time ago. More than 20 years ago, probably. Someone has an insight, someone has a breakthrough, and goes to the teacher to report the insight, how there's clarity or oneness with everything, or not two, not one, or whatever language. And the teacher, instead of saying, "Great, come join me up on the teacher's platform," said, "Where did you put your shoes? Where is your umbrella, to the left of your shoes or to the right of your shoes? When you came in, what did you do with your shoes and your umbrella?" And the person couldn't remember and was sent away for 12 more years of practice. So it's a great story and something that happens to us every day. A little bit of shift and we think we can escape all of this confusion and chaos and be done. And then we're sent away for 12 more years. That's the story. And then the funny thing my mind did with the story, of course, bound to happen, may it not happen to you, is I'll go into the hall and then when I'm coming back out, do I remember where my shoes were? There'll be a concern because it's like a sign of how I'm doing if I remember where my shoes are. And so then there could accidentally come different strategies about how to remember where your shoes are. Like put them always in the same place. So it's easy. And then the weird thing that the mind does with the story starts to get annoying. Not only funny, and then it's funny again, etc. So just to see how my mind made two options, remembering the shoes and not remembering the shoes. And then again, two options, caring about remembering the shoes and not caring about remembering the shoes. And so barefoot is a third option that doesn't come to our mind when we're stuck with the two. I remembered my shoes, or I forgot my shoes, or I don't care where my shoes are, or I do care. So just as another way to joke, the times that one comes barefoot to the hall and comes out of the hall and says, "Where are your shoes?" Or, no story. The kind of pull, the little tug of did I or didn't I or do I or don't I, completely irrelevant for a moment. So I want to go back to this, what turns out to be this really beautiful image of the shadow that never leaves from the Dhammapada. And I love how this these opening lines from the Dhammapada that can come across as so boring or not really saying that much or being kind of not so fresh. By going into it and spreading it out and hearing different versions of the story, and finally we can actually get into this really beautiful image and the contrast of the two images, the wheel following the bull, the wheel of the cart following the bull as it steps, and the shadow that never leaves. So a movement as the bull starts to move, at first it takes some to get going, and as it gets going, it's then harder and harder to stop. So that's one image that we could allow to come into us. And then in contrast, a shadow that follows us as we walk, or the shadow of a tree that we could come into. A shadow is a definite thing, and forgive me for kind of going into this if you already did that yourself in your own digestion of the talk 2 days ago. But it still seems worth saying out loud how important the difference is between a wheel and a bull, that contrast with a shadow that has nothing. There's no substance, and at the same time, it's very definite, it's defined. It has a certain shape, but we can't hold on to it. We can get into a shadow. We can make a shadow. It's not that it doesn't exist. And it has effects. It's usually cooling, usually darkening. But it has no substance. And so the shadow being what happens when we allow undistorted mind to let life come through, then there's a cooling shadow that never leaves. So something we can't grasp, something we can't hold on to, but we can actually find and feel. We can notice it. We can notice that it's dark, we can't see as well. So we can't use our overly alert eyes. Our eyes tend to be so on that we miss a lot. And as we start to quiet down, it can be that we're sometimes less on, and so something different happens with the eyes. We can notice a few things more unexpectedly. Something comes to our gaze. And without needing to figure it out, there's some communication or some sense of importance in what has been seen. So sometimes by seeing less, we can see more. We can more fully, sorry, I didn't mean to be so powerful. A lot of gas. Maybe seeing less, being less on in our eyes, less out through our eyes, and more letting color come in. Maybe it's a more fully meeting, more fully seen. And there can be a sense, a different kind of importance that just comes across to us. We might see something in nature and we can't figure out what meaning it has for us, but we feel something happen, something comes across. So for me, there are those long seed pods from one kind of tree, dark brown with the cross marks from the seeds. There's something about that pattern that says something to me when I see it. If I would go and get one and try to look at it and figure it out, I don't think that would come across in the same way. Sometimes we might see something and it allows us to respond to a practical situation. And we might tend to divide that practical response from that other kind of more mysterious response. And may we, could we, would we, what if we don't divide? What if we allow room for, sometimes the response appears practical, sometimes the response appears mysterious and passive. But what happens if for a while, for a few days, we don't let that idea that it's different come in as much? I also like the image of shadow or shade as a natural response to brightness and substance. So when there's brightness, there's a light, and then there's a thing. There's a body of some kind, maybe a tree, maybe a blade of grass, maybe your foot. Then there's a shadow also. It goes together. And so just getting the feeling of how that all goes together. And my friend Peter Friedlander points out that in that line of the Dhammapada, talking about an undistorted mind allowing words and actions that bring happiness to happen. In between that open mind that's not distorted, so it's not tricking us, and the possibility of freer words and actions, in between is a kind of brightness, clarity, or seeing. That's not the busy seeing, another kind of seeing, but a brightness, which happens to be pasana, like vipassana, or pasyana in Sanskrit. That brightness we can meet when we let ourselves be ordinary and we let things be ordinary. The brightness of us and things can come up, can come through. And it gives a cooling kind of shade at the same time. Something we can't grasp, so it's not a thing we could count on, but we can rely upon ordinariness to leave room for brightness and shade. In the meeting with substance, brightness and substance. So we're not trying to get so bright that all we lose our body and all the world disappears and we can just be away for a while. But in the substance of life, in it, in here, not out there. If we try to remember or leave room to remember a moment or moments of ordinariness, and maybe in a kind of sense of ordinariness, nothing special, not needing to be special, not needing to be special. That there can be a change in the sense perceptions as that shift out of needing to be special into not needing to be special sometimes happens upon us. There can be a shift in perception. So one example is with the eyes, where we're usually going out through our eyes in our over alertness or trying to be careful or trying to get it right or whatever. A shift happens and that can, the eyes soften, and sometimes literally the colors brighten, the colors get more alive, and maybe even the light lightens. Similar kinds of shifts of perception may sometimes happen with sound or touch or other senses, including the mind as a sense. So if we just have this possibility of feeling the difference between when the senses, so hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking, feeling, being a small me, the mind sense, that many times they're they're on too much, they're too on. And that in a way, they're kind of asked to be too on. But instead of trying to block out or block ourselves from our senses, if we let them be more off, more on vacation, without avoidance, without trying to get away. What we need to get away from, because it's too much, is that over alertness, being too careful, too worried, too presenting, too trying to be special. It's not our fault, like there's some way that we're designed that way, but we're also designed to be able to turn it off or let it come off. If you're thinking, oh, I've never had one of those moments, it's not true. It's your mind telling a lie. Okay? So don't believe the lie. We couldn't be here if it were always on. Because it's always on, it has to go off. But usually when it goes off, we go off. And so we don't notice. So with resting, there's a chance for something of us to still be awake when the senses are quiet, more quiet, including the mind sense. And that's not all that there is. So there's nothing left, nothing. There's nothing. And yet, there's a freshness in that less seeing, a brightness. And again, it's so good. So we're coming to the third doorkeeper, which is called, I'm finally going to tell you one of the Sanskrit names, Santusht. Maybe even the sound in the sound of the word, Santusht. Wouldn't you like to be called that? Santush, Santushti. Even with its slight, like tush in English is this part of the body. Even with that slight. What did she just say? And it's often translated as contentment. And I'm calling it ordinariness. As a doorkeeper of enlightenment. Were you raising your hand?
Yes, I was.
Or playing with gravity?
No.
Okay.
Is it
magister? No.
Okay. Well, what I've been wondering the most basis, if the mind is the sense.
Yeah, if.
What is it sense? So hearing senses, like radio waves.
Yeah. 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 Good. So, from what I understand, like Peter's translation of it is like mental phenomena, which really could be everything. All the other perceptions. So, in we could understand it maybe this way as a starting point, but being puzzled is so good. Also, could you hear what she asked? Sorry. Not so much. She's been puzzling about if mind is a sense, so then what is it kind of receiving? If the ear receives audio waves, what does the mind as a sense organ receive? Yeah? And that she's been puzzling over that for a couple of days. So first option is puzzling more. That would be really good. And yeah, yeah. And we could also wonder, like, in as part of the puzzling, we could wonder whether it could be that way that hearing isn't just the sound waves coming into the ear, because then the ear from there goes to the brain to say, this is what I think I just heard. So maybe it has something to do with the way all the senses report to somewhere in our, as far as we know now, the brain. So all of that, plus all the other mental phenomena. So at least thinking and emotion. So it could be that it receives that, maybe electromagnetic fields, for example. But it might not be so technically precise, like as the ear hears the audio waves, so it might not be like that. Yeah. So there's room for more wondering. Yeah. More wonder. With the wondering, it's good to leave not too much room for like the that where we start to, as if we have a horse with ropes and we're not sure where we want to go, so we keep stopping by thinking a lot. But still wondering and puzzling, but sometimes bringing it down, not only saying to you. Could I just say one thing?
No, yes, please.
Okay. I wanted to say one more thing about ordinariness, santushti. It's at the same time not needing to have or get anything, and at the same time also a sense of having everything. At the same time not needing to take a position or not even having a position, and at the same time having everywhere. Krishnamurti talks about how we've gone for getting. We've gotten into a habit and a culture of getting. So he calls it acquisitiveness, which is, we could say, more like a sense that I've got to get something. I've got to get a lot of things, or I've got to get that one thing, but I've got to get it first and then live. Getting that, then I'll be creative. Getting that, then I'll be at peace, etc. And he agrees with me, I agree with him, that this is something that we've been developing the last couple centuries, being more and more individualistic. And then we get this really wrong idea that doesn't actually work out well for anyone, including ourselves. Not even just this kind of idea, but the the whole mind goes into action to get for me. I gotta get for me. Because in my experience, no one else will, because they're getting for them. I'll get for me, then I'll give, maybe. Or getting for me will be so good for me that it'll kind of be good for everyone. Or whatever excuse. Mm. And then we lose track of actually what, if there's something we want, what we wanted. because we're assuming that we want something. We're assuming that we need something to be okay. And it, when I say assuming, it's not quite right. There's a whole body sensation that I must get it before I can be okay. So it's not like my wrong assumption or whatever. So we've been developing that. And Krishnamurti agrees with me and I with him that this is what the world looks like now because of this. But if we think of the shadow and how cooling and how allowing things to have their brightness, their reality, their substance, and their mystery, the shadow, so being in real touch with real things inside and outside. Without that movement of gotta get. It's not ordinariness as settling for less.
So what helps me think about mind as a sense, and now even thinking about me as a sense, non-ordinary me. I think about, right, I really dwell in the fact that the other sense, the first five, the usual five, they don't exist without some substance. So hearing as a sense can't exist without the snapping. There's no, in void, there's no hearing without sound, without form, right? Same with seeing, so you need the withness. And I think of the mind sense as that withness.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of encompasses the other five, but it's separate from the other five.
So the only thing there is that the mind is part of the picture, that man is part of the picture, that needs to be there for hearing to happen. But like in the Buddhist traditions, they talk a lot about this. So there, as you're saying, you're calling it withness, there needs to be withness, there needs to be a thing, and there needs to be an apparatus, there needs to be the equipment, the thing that can hear, that could hear. And they call it contact, so you're saying the witness.
Mm-hmm.
But they also talk about the need for attention, which is a movement of mind rather than. So there needs to be that mind. And actually, Peter, my friend Peter, in the Dhammapada lines translated man as consciousness in that sense, as like a simple functional consciousness. That has to be there so that here there's the thing that could be heard, there's the thing that could hear, there's the contact, and there's the I'm paying attention to the sound to some degree. So the man needs to be there, but attention also. So contact. And maybe putting it out this way can help us again feel the possibility of, is there the possibility of hearing a sound without a thing, without an object, without something making a noise? I would say there is. And some people talk about a primordial sound. So maybe there's like there is creation, there is stuff. There's not anyone making it, you know, a noise. And there maybe doesn't even need to be ears that work. I don't know. I haven't asked around yet. That's a good. But the possibility of our sensing what also isn't an object, just like we can feel a shadow and we can see a shadow. There's the possibility of hearing in another way, possibly not through those drums and those wires or whatever. And so exactly, to be open to, in the normal hearing, and also maybe some other kind of hearing, in the ordinary. In appreciation of how rich it all is. There are sounds, for example. And even the part of us that doesn't like the machine sound because of our past, and does like the bird sound because of our past, even that can be rich, but somehow, like, not bothering about that. So not bothering about if I remember where my shoes are or not. Not bothering about whether I like the sound or not, but without fighting that, also just hearing, just simple hearing. So I'm not talking about cosmic hearing, just simple hearing. Just feeling, if maybe it happens now, that full contact, or a more full contact with the sound we don't like, with the sound we do like, with the sound we didn't notice. On the way, it can be very interesting to get to know ourselves better, to get to know the way the mind works better. So as you start to pay attention to the soundscape, to open to the sounds right now, were there sounds that you didn't notice? If there are sounds that you didn't notice, are they the ones now that you notice you don't like? Or are they the sounds that you notice now? Oh, I didn't notice that insect sound. That's kind of nice. Was it something you didn't like that you didn't notice? Was it something that you did like that you didn't notice? So along the way, we get to know where the doors close and open automatically in our mind. And that can be good to know, so that there starts to be less of doors. Less of opening and closing, less of, are my shoes to the left of my umbrella, to the right, or do I care? I forgot. One of my teachers, Punjaji, made a good joke. Most of his life he taught. Even as a child, he taught. Even as a child, he sneaked into his mother's clothing and pulled out one of her saris and put it on like an Indian monk, or whatever you want to call it, sadhu, in what is now Pakistan, so not in an area where that was necessarily so common to see. And went outside on the street and started preaching, started teaching. I think he was 8. And after a lot of intense practice and also meetings with different teachers, and including his teacher who lived on that mountain there, Ramna, he made a good escape plan usually. He liked to give the teachings and then send people away, and if they didn't go away, he would disappear. And he just loved to live really simply by the Ganga River, with a rock as his plate and cooking on the fire and enjoying life. And sometimes he kind of suggested that as he got older and couldn't travel as easily and couldn't travel alone, so he couldn't just disappear, sometimes he even would say, meet me at the train station and we're going to go to Hardwar or whatever. And he walked in the train one side and went out the other side and got on another train and went somewhere else. And where is he? A little bit like the shadow. Not reliable in our usual sense of the word. So in the last years of his life, people started to be around him and wanted to be as near to him physically as they possibly could, as much of the time as they could, day and night. So he made this statement, which has its truth and its power, and at the same time, I want you to know that he did have people who were at the door, like not letting everyone in at midnight and so on. Sometimes they would go in at midnight. If Papaji heard someone and said, no, is that so-and-so? Bring them in. I have some sweets for her or whatever. But he said about the issue of who to let in, whom to let in and when to let them in and for how long they could stay and whether he needed to rest. People would talk about the door, opening the door, closing the door. And he said, just notice that there's no door, or take it off the hinges, take it off. So in ordinariness, we can notice that the door is off or there isn't a door. Just the color of the light on the grass, that you can't feel if it's happening in here, out there, you can't feel the difference. So another American poet named Denise Levertov talks about her first love, which was when she was a child, just learning to speak, and she had a meeting. There was this looking that happened. She said, looking completely, so face upturned, looking completely, openly into my eyes. It looked at me. I looked back. Delight filled me as if I, not the flower, were a flower, and brim full, so full to the top, with rain. It was a flower about this big. So the flower, face upturned, looking completely. So I don't know if you've noticed, but sometimes it helps when someone mentions that. We could notice that flowers look completely. Often their face is upturned, not always. They look openly. They might look into your eyes. It looked at me. I looked back. Delight filled me as if I, not the flower, were a flower. And brim full of rain. And then she says, and then there was endlessness. Sorry, shouldn't say and then, she says. And there was endlessness. Perhaps through a lifetime, what I've desired has always been to return to that endless giving and receiving, the wholeness of that attention. That once in a lifetime, secret communion. When we fall out of the neediness and the plan and the worry, there is endlessness. And it's not sure if it's I or the flower who is a flower. And it uncovers what she's calling life, a lifetime desire that may have always been to return to that endless giving and receiving. The wholeness of that attention. So we have attention as that other ingredient in hearing, for example. And we know different kinds of attention, different ways of paying attention. Sometimes we pay attention. And sometimes there's a wholeness of attention. And I like how she says that once in a lifetime, secret communion, partly because however many times it happens, it's a once in a lifetime. It's enough. It's so enough, even once. But then why not, santushti, why not? If it's enough, so then let's live in enough. In that secret communion. So communion, union together. It's almost like a repetitive word. Communion. Together, together. Wholeness of attention. That wholeness of attention. That secret communion. So it's not a showy thing. I'm not showing off. There's no energy left to show it off because it's all absorbed in that wholeness. That once in a lifetime. It's not another thing to rack up on my book that I got another or that I can't get. So beyond counting. So once in a lifetime also means beyond counting. Any questions or anything to say? Yeah. Sorry, a little bit louder.
From spaciousness of emptiness, there's no need for it. There's no need for gentleness from gentleness.
I can't hear you, sorry.
There's no need for gentleness from gentleness.
Yeah.
There's no need. And there seems to be an apparent paradox that the mind picks it up. The idea that it needs it, and that actually the movement happens from ordinariness, not from the mind back. So it seems like it's a happening out of control of me.
Take your time.
Your experience of when the me starts to try to do it, because then the me at some point gets a taste, tastes it and like, so then it needs it, it wants it, and so, and that reaffirms the duality of it, because then it creates the one that needs it.
Right. Or many questions also. Do you want to say more? Does it feel like it would help to say more? It's good.
It seems like an empty question because it doesn't, in a sense, athlete who doesn't feel that is an answer, because the only thing you could answer, you could give me an answer, but then if I listen to the answer, then
you've
given me an answer which doesn't help, which isn't unhelpful in a sense, you know what I mean? In a sense, because it's like, it's the mind that wants to know, I don't know,
yeah.
So it's always that, but it's only an apparent contradiction, because it actually is, doesn't exist, but when you're in the contradiction, it feels real.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe it's something about your experience of that.
What I like to suggest to all of us is to feel our own individual, so not individualistic, but our own individual shape or flavor. Shape or flavor. That's one way to put it. So just like we probably each feel more bright or tuned or whatever, sensitive in one of the senses, or not just like, but similarly, and maybe related to that, there's an individual flavor or feeling quality that's our natural connected, our natural connection flavor. We are naturally connected in different ways to some extent, etc. Sometimes we're more aware of it, sometimes less, but it has a kind of like our inner flavor. And it's so close, it can take a few years to know it as we come across it. Or maybe being open to that we can feel in others. Again, not in that mode of defense and so I like and I don't like, but like we can play with the sounds and then we can play that with people. And we can play that with mind states. I like it or I don't like it is irrelevant completely. It's something that happens, yeah. Within seconds, we like it or we don't like it. Faster than the seconds. But within seconds with people, they say like less than 3 seconds and we like it or we don't like it. Fine. And completely irrelevant. Feeling other people's, even how much I don't like them, but there's still that natural connection, atmosphere, something we can't quite, like a shadow, we can't, as soon as we put too many words, it's not quite it. Right.
But if you look and you look at something, it's not that you look out, it's not that you look in, but you neither look out and look in.
Yeah.
And you sit there where it's neither one way or the other.
Yeah.
And there is the shade.
Yeah.
But then there's a movement in the mind, like, ah, so it looks further in.
Mm.
Or then the attention is drawn out.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's kind of finding that, it's like that pendulum swing is where.
But so. That's just another, like, are my shoes there or do I care? Or and so it's sometimes through my just giving in to the natural flavor can be a way to help to give in so that we can accommodate also that movement of this or that movement of
really more, it feels like it's more like an invitation. That all you can do is provide the invitation, and the rest is.
Mm.
I don't know,
yeah. What I mean to say, though, is that there is something, again, like a shadow, without substance, but very definite.
Yeah.
It's very specific.
Mm.
That is specifically helpful. And it doesn't matter what we think about it or feel about it,
yeah.
And it just comes across.
Yeah.
It can. Or, as you said, like, it's not exactly a direction. And so it could be sometimes an open invitation and sometimes a really, really specific. Tuning into what already is, but in that specific way. And then we don't need to keep that. It already was with us from before, we know. And that helps kind of practice so even the movement of mind, even the sense of me, even the sense that feeling that I, whatever, the sense of small mind, is nothing special. And so that can also be in ordinariness meeting. And sometimes then there's a sense of a kind of possible chemistry that's very specific, or alchemy, that's a very specific, it's not just randomly any molecule with other molecule will do something, but only that and only that, in only these conditions, something else. And so that's just the whisper of the fourth doorkeeper that we'll call for today, chemistry or alchemy. So today we're talking about that secret communion, ordinariness. So leaving off the burden of the need to be special, but not making it a problem that the need to be special comes up almost all the time, if we're honest. Keep coming back and subtle, gross, subtle, gross. But that's ordinary, no big deal. And so is all of this, wow. So is all of this, wow. So is also, so in that not so much neediness about getting, there's that opening, the senses relax. We're not constantly in need of being in contact to confirm me. And so it gets loose. Things get loose. Sometimes it's scary, as Stu said last time, and then we jump to thinking to try to be safe, and then we realize that's not helping, etc. In loose, chemistry starts to be possible. In loose, secret communion starts to be possible. Enough for today. Feels like there's more for another time, a whole other way of taking your question. So let's just have a moment of quiet. May all beings be peaceful. May all be peaceful.